Okay, so before we get started and start tackling our topic, I want to give an introduction on two levels. Number one, once again, to give our Karasat Tov to our hosts and those who are hosting nominally this evening, as well as those who will be hosting, I guess, next week. Or I guess we will be alternating, God willing. So we should be at the Coleman's next week, is that right? And then going back and forth. Okay. So, did you go there first?
No.
Okay, we're good. Okay. How many people are at the Coleman's right now knocking at their hearts? Oh, yes. All right, so that's Hakar Satov once again, as last year as well, and very excited with the Chagim behind us to get underway. As you know, we're going to be looking at medical ethics, in particular, by request from this group. We're going to be starting with a look at the subject of end-of-life topics. Tonight's topic in particular, I think, is a sensitive one, and I'll try my best, certainly, to handle it in that way. But it really, I have halachic knowledge about this. It's not something that I deal with, not to deal with it on too regular a basis, although it is something that I have dealt with in a rabbinic capacity in a practical way in terms of some of the questions that come up. But in particular, the question of halachic will, especially as it pertains to medical matters, is obviously a sensitive one and a very important one. And my goal for this evening is really twofold. Is number one, to offer the halachic background and sort of use that to parlay it into a look at sort of the practical elements in what it means to devise a halachic will. Tonight we're going to be focusing, at least the second part, on looking at the practical pieces of the medical will, and then we're going to be looking probably next week at questions of inheritance. The question of, in terms of leaving money to the next generation. So I know it's these are sensitive topics, but certainly there's an opportunity to talk things out as well, and I'd love to hear any insights from anyone along those lines. Also, he's not able to be here this evening, but I'm happy to acknowledge that Nachum Solman, along with his family, wonderful family, are generously have offered to sponsor our mini-series. So if he's planning to be here, I guess he couldn't make it this evening. But a shout-out to the Stolman family, Nachum. If anyone's spoken with him about medical matters, he has very passionate opinions. It's his life. Shomer Shabbos stuff and all these kinds of things. Something I've spoken with him on many occasions about, and they're wonderful friends as well. So I want to thank the Stolman family for that. Okay, so with that introduction, we're going to do three things specifically this evening. Number one, look at the background from the Jewish sources. Number two, talk a little bit about the general structure of the medical wills that are out there. And then look concretely at least one instance, one example of a halachic will that has been put out there for public use. And I'm going to walk through the sort of the practical elements of what that contains, and certainly can open conversation as we go along. All right, so I think it's really fascinating to note from the outset that from the Torah through Tanakh and then into the rabbinic tradition and then come to the Rishon LeAchron, the later authorities, we find a willingness and a sensitivity and yet a comfort with addressing head-on these sorts of topics, that there's an awareness that these are complex issues, that these are sensitive and very real questions, and yet not a shying away. It's very important, we see throughout, I think, literature, for an individual to find, while someone is still relatively well, where that's possible, where the realities on the ground, which sometimes are uncontrollable, but where the realities allow for that, to try to put one's affairs in order, whether it's in terms of financial matters, whether in terms of its questions of burial, whether it's in terms of, we'll see the medical side of things a little bit later on, but I think that it's fascinating to see that, and I want to trace that just a little bit. So the first example I gave in source one is from Yaakov Avinu. You might recall that toward the very end of his life, Yaakov Avinu spends an entire chapter, in a way, putting his affairs in order, and he begins with what we might call, sort of, an ethical will. An ethical will is a different angle on these kinds of things. An ethical will might just be a way of communicating to the next generation what my values are, what my priorities are. And in a sense, I think it's more than that, but in a sense, Yaakov's brachot, his blessings to the Shvatim, to the tribes, and every single one is tailor-made. There's clearly an interpersonal awareness and sensitivity that Yaakov possesses. It's really remarkable. Every Shevet receives its own blessing, its own message, with an understanding that is tailor-made for that particular individual, and yet they all flow from Yaakov's values, they all flow perhaps from a certain degree of prophecy, but at the same time, ultimately what he's doing is he is, for each and every one individually, offering a sort of an ethical will. And then Yaakov goes beyond that, and Yaakov specifically arranges for matters. Very early, he says, in Pasuk Chafes, what I give you over here, Vaitzav, what's up, Yom Rahim, so he arranges for matters of burial, and so on and so forth, and he says, please bury me back in Me'arat HaMachpelah. And how does the parak conclude, which I think is very telling? Yaakov finishes to instruct his sons, and what happens? At that point, what does he do? He says, now, right, he passes on. And I always understood that there's almost a cadence here, that there's almost a sense that Yaakov was blessed to anticipate. Again, not ever, it doesn't always go that way, but Yaakov did have that opportunity, and there's almost a sense of completion to his life. And so, almost the sense that Vayichal Yaakov etzavot et benav, and then he was ready to move on. Almost as if to say that Yaakov Avinu is offering us, by implication, through his own life example, the importance of confronting these issues and arranging matters as one sees fit, and then going on from there. And I think that then that would imply sharing that wisdom with others, that if there are others in our lives who might be uncomfortable having that conversation, it's important for them to confront these questions, even though they can be deeply uncomfortable, that Yaakov sets a model for us. And Yaakov does not say, well, I don't want to confront this, as painful as it might be. Yaakov is willing, even as uncomfortable as it is, to address these issues and to put his affairs in place. And I think that that's quite a remarkable example, and I wonder aloud if the Torah is kind of using this as an opportunity to emphasize the importance of trying, where possible, to arrange these matters in advance. And that's the example of Yaakov. There are many others that we could offer. I give another example of David HaMelech. Very interesting. Toward the very end of David HaMelech's life, we come to the beginning, toward the earlier parts of Sefer Melachim. Like, if we made David Lamud, Vaitzavit Shlomo, Vinovei Morse, he says, Shlomo, you're going to be the king. Remember, David HaMelech has to deal with many rebellions, including from his own children, tremendous complexities, Avshalom, and all these stories. But then, toward the very end of his life, Shlomo HaMelech is ensconced. He's going to be the next king. He gives him a sort of an ethical will, and that takes us to the psukim that you have here. And he offers his instructions. And plus, okay, there is even something that's it's actually, he says, well, there's someone who requires an appropriate vengeance. Someone has rebelled against the king and requires chiv misa. They must be executed, as it were. And that's part of what he instructs. And then at the same time, Shaul HaMelech and Avshalom's families, these are people who had given him quite the difficult time in his life. Avshalom, his own son, had rebelled against him, and yet he says the family members must be permitted to eat at the table. You need to treat them with tremendous humaneness and tremendous compassion, and he puts that in order as well. And then again, Pasuk Yud, toward the bottom of that page, Vayishka David Mavotav, Vayikaver Biyur David, there's again that sense of finality. And indeed, the psukim emphasize Ushlamo Yashav, last pasuk, Ushlamo Yashav Kisei David Aviv, Vatikon Machut HaMe'od. Again, there's no guarantee, but the idea that Shlomo sat upon the throne of his father David and his rule was firmly established, I think, implies, again, the psukim, I think, convey the importance of engaging in these kinds of difficult conversations.
Did you happen to coincidentally pick these two sections, because that the section from Malachim is the Haftorah for the section from Bereishis?
Well, I think
I don't know Tanakh very well, but that's Parshas Vayechi, that's Haftorah for Vayechi.
That's the reason, and that's the reason that that's chosen after. Absolutely right to mention it. Now I know it's so many pages; it didn't double. Double sided. I don't know what happened. So you certainly have, absolutely, and that's what goes together, because David HaMelech's preparations are strikingly parallel to the Yaakov Avinu. It's exactly the same, or it's the same structure. He puts everything in place, he gives those instructions.
But that also tells you that they chose to stress that aspect of Parshas Vayechi in the Haftorah, as opposed to other things that go on in Vayechi.
So you're saying it's not just, that's a great insight, you're saying it's not just the example of Yaakov, and it's not just the example of David, but Chazal themselves, by choosing to juxtapose these, are themselves underscoring the importance of this value, which dovetails beautifully with some later sources that we'll see. Very well said. Very, very nice. I like that insight. Yeah, I think you're all in agreement, 100%. Now, I'm going to go a little bit out of order for just a moment. If you jump to source 12, this is a couple of pages later in the handout, and you have a comment of the Ralbag. The Ralbag, or of Levi Ben Gershom, is one of the great Spanish medieval commentators. Ralbag does something fascinating. He has a running commentary on Tanakh, and at the end of every chapter, to the best of my knowledge, on which he comments, he offers a summary of the primary lessons that we're meant to derive from that section. almost as if to say, Tanakh is meant to teach us ethical, moral lessons. What are they? What can we derive from this story? And he says, sometimes he'll give just one, two, or three. Sometimes he'll go on for quite a while. In this particular case, he offers no less than 12 lessons that emerge from this chapter with regard to the end of the life of David HaMelech. It says 12. So I'm going to give you 11 out of 12, but there's a lot to learn. I think it's a very beautiful approach to studying Tanakh, and it makes a lot of sense, very intuitive. And he says, Hayud Aleph, because this is source 12. Hayud Aleph, he says, Vehu b'midot, is with regard to matters of character. And the 11th lesson from this chapter concerns one's character, he says. Vehu, namely, Lehodia Shiroi Lechol Adam, Shiitzaveh Beit Moto Hamun Hagim Mimenu, V'yadrichim al hatov v'chima she'ashar, k'azif sak mimenu davar musaro be'atid. V'lazer o'i she'ishtadal azak mutam ya musar ma she'ispok le'machar ma'atari. So the 11th lesson from this chapter, from the story of David, concerns one's character, namely to convey that it is fitting for any person to command those whom he influences at the time of his death and lead them to the good as much as possible. For after that point, his guidance will cease in the future. Therefore, it is fitting for one to try to convey those lessons to them in a fashion that will continue to have an effect after his death. In other words, he overuses the terminology of an ethical will. That's really quite remarkable. Sometimes you hear these stories about people, even in earlier stages in life. You know, on the first birthday, they're going to write you that letter. Anyone do anything like this? You write that some people are right, you're 1 year old, and then at your wedding, you can open the letter, right? Or when you're 26, 25 years later, I've seen that as well. That sort of thing, that sort of ability to see ahead and to anticipate. What are the messages that when you're, God willing, mature enough, you'll be able to really appreciate? These are the aspirations that we had for you at that tender stage in your life. Rabban sees those as well when it comes to the later stages as well. So it's a very beautiful kind of idea, if again, it can be difficult to confront for all of us in very understandable ways, and for everyone in a different kind of fashion. Chazal also are quite aware of this. I gave you in source 3, jumping back. The Mishnah classically says, look, you have to be honest. We have to have a certain sobriety. Chazal is a more Yom Kippur type material, but that idea that you should look at 3 things and then you won't come to sin. If we're very honest about where we come, by the way, on the whole other Dvar Torah, I don't think this is just meant to have us focus on the morbidity or sort of our ultimate destiny to just return to where we came, but I think it's actually meant there's an optimistic element as well. That the idea that lifnei miata atid l'tein din v'cheshbon, right? Notice that although it's true we're going to go back to become a putrid drop when we pass away, nonetheless, which other beings in existence will give din v'cheshbon? Which other types of creatures that are living will actually have some sort of judgment before the Almighty? We don't assume that animals or and so on and so forth, even other living creatures, will have that opportunity. So the Mishnah is almost at once saying, yes, we will return. There's a sense of our humility, of our mortality, of our smallness, and yet, at the same time, of that which distinguishes humanity, the fact that only we are a tibli tindin v'cheshbon. Be that as it may, certainly that willingness to confront quite honestly is there. There's another midrash, which I think is a very clever, interesting way of putting this, and it caught my attention. I want to share with you along these lines as well. And that appears in source number 4, Midrash from Devarim Rabbah. And it simply says, and to have to credit this source and a number of the sources that we're using, there are a couple of what have become canonical texts on Jewish medical ethics in general. We'll mention them over the course of our study together, God willing. And I'll hopefully bring in some show and tell as we go. There's an encyclopedia of Jewish medical ethics, 4 volumes that exist. There are other very important works that exist. But there's a book that was just published by someone, I wouldn't call him a friend, just I haven't gotten to know him very well yet, an acquaintance out in California. His name is Rabbi Jason Wiener. Jason Wiener is not a doctor, and yet somehow he found himself with a full-time position as a chaplain for a hospital. I think it's called Cedar Sinai Hospital, I hope that's the right name, out in Los Angeles. Has a small pulpit, that's a part-time position, but his full-time position is actually embedded in the hospital, and over the course of the last significant number of years, pretty much what he does from day till evening, morning till evening, is he works with families and he counsels people going through all sorts of different things, and they create very beautiful and moving. I've seen some of his posts. He finally got on Facebook because he just published a new book. soon to promote the new book, and it's a book on Jewish medical ethics. He's in regular contact. Not only is he unbelievably humane and working closely as a pastor to people from all walks of Jewish life and beyond, but he is also regularly in touch with some of the leading poskim, some of the leading halachic decisors in matters of Jewish medical ethics, but people like Rav Asher Weiss, so it's a name that perhaps some have heard, is one of the outstanding rabbinical leaders in Yerushalayim. Rav Asher is an extraordinary human being on so many levels. Here you have, we live in a world that's unfortunately discussed this, I think last year at one point, in a relatively fractured Jewish community. It's not the first time that's existed, but certainly to some, a significant degree is the case today. And Rav Asher is one of those few people who is accepted across the board. I would say revered across an extremely wide swath of certainly the Israeli population, the Jewish community. An extraordinary human being is Beit Midrash. It's open to anyone who wants to come and learn. And he encourages so many people to participate, and he just has a warmth. He also has both a Litvish and Hasidic background. Sort of he mixes them together. He has Hasidic roots, and he dresses in a Hasidic, relatively, not overdone, but Hasidic garb essentially, and yet he has Litvish influences and experience. So he himself is a fusion in a very beautiful way of different traditions within our own heritage. And he has emerged as one of the leading poskim, perhaps the leading poskim at this point, with regard to matters of Jewish medical ethics, after Eliezer Veldenberg, who was previously, in the previous generation, he was perhaps the greatest Jewish medical poskim. After he passed away, Rav Asher became the poskim, Halachic Decisor, for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, which is the only hospital in the world, best of my knowledge, that strictly follows matters of halacha with regard to everything that it does. And so he is the poskim for the hospital. So Rabbi Wiener is constantly in touch with Rav Asher Weiss and many others as well. Published a brand new book, God willing, I'll bring it in. It's been a lot of fun. So I worked through a couple of the sections at least, and it's extremely well footnoted. He also knows personally. He's not just reading books. He understands all the different pieces. He understands the halachic side. He's not a trained doctor, but he works very closely with doctors, and he's cautious about what he's learned and what he's learning, but he's come to, that's from what I can tell, he has a firm, and from what I've heard from others as well, is a firm knowledge of the medical side as well, and in addition, he's working with people who are struggling, and so he's really seeing all the different sides of what a real-life halachic question is. So this is a source that I saw from him, so I'm going to give credit where credit is due. And if you're interested in the book, you can go find it on Amazon and anywhere else where they still sell books these days. So good bookstores as well. We like bookstores. I'm excited. Big fan. Anyhow, so he brought this source to my attention. He says, or the Midrash says rather, Mahu, what does it mean in Kohelet? And the Im Shilton Beyon Hamavet. What does it mean there's no authority over the day of death? So the Midrash explains very simply, very bluntly, Ein Adam Shalit Lomar, no one has the capacity to say, hold on one second, right, as it were, to the Malach HaMavis. Hantinuli, just hold on one second, I gotta get everything in order. But until I arrange my affairs and I command my household, then I'm gonna come. Right, it says that you can't just say the Malach HaMavis, as it were, just give me a couple of days and then I'll come back to you when I'm ready. So it's just sort of like a very realistic depiction, but it's, I don't know if it's humorous, but it's almost, I think it's characteristic of Chazal's willingness to be really honest about these kinds of things and say, look, it just doesn't work that way. And therefore, the Midrash is recommending that one go ahead now while one is, thank God, healthy and well and so on and so forth, that one should go ahead and make those arrangements wherever possible. In other words, even when someone is at an earlier stage of life, that there's a value to recommending to members of a community to go ahead and to go ahead with these matters, that's a good thing, that one should not be, can struggle with things like Ein Hara and so on and so forth, but that nonetheless one should try to move ahead with these matters. You have in Shulchan Aruch, it's actually halacha, that Omrim, though, that we recommend in Yeradeya, Shin Lama Hezayin 335:7, Omrim lo shitin da'atol in Yanav, we actually tell a patient, this is someone who's already ill, in Hovam hifgidol yetzachim achim hovo hifgidu etzol yivchad mekneizem ahamaveh, we encourage such an individual not to be afraid. In other words, not that we tell a person not to have emotions, God forbid, but rather that we say to the person encourage this individual not to allow the fear of death to overcome the person to the point that they don't put these matters in order in this sort of scenario. Now, there are different traditions that I'll tell this, and some of them went further than some of us might be comfortable with, and then I think would be appropriate for most communities today, but just to give a sense as to the willingness to confront these issues and yet the awareness of the sensitivity of these matters that our rabbis had. I gave you in source 6 an example from the Chachmas Adam. Chachmas Adam is Rav Danzig. Ravram Danzig is one of the great halakhic authorities of the 19th century in Eastern Europe, and he wrote one of the classic sets of codifications of halakha. Chaye Adam and Chochmat Adam, these deal with many of the classic practical halakhic matters that we encounter on a daily basis. So there's something that's a section, it's called Shar HaSimcha, which is euphemistic. This is a description of times of literally means rejoicing, but in this context it refers to matters of life and death. And so he says, Hamnag Mikilo Kido Shod, he says, the custom in holy communities, Uvifrat Bikihila Kedisha Berlin. He says, what's the practice in Berlin? And so he goes on and he says that if a person is sick for 3 days, now I don't know what kind of illness, I assume this doesn't mean what we would consider today the common cold. And he says the person is sick for 3 days, probably means a significant illness, although at that time the mortality rates were very different than what they are nowadays. So I don't know exactly what kind of illness he's referring to, but either way, when it's substantial and it's been continuing for some significant period of time, so he actually says that the community practice was that we go over to such an individual and we say, don't allow the concerns that you have to dissuade you from going ahead and putting matters in order and to putting a will in place and so on and so forth. Okay, so far it's pretty much the same as we've seen. But then he says that he says the minhag in Berlin is to go over to such an individual and to encourage such a person to go ahead and say vidor. Yeah, that's what I said when I read this. Vidu is typically what's said when someone is literally on a deathbed, of course. And he says, nonetheless, if the person apparently has a significant illness, we should encourage someone to do this where it's appropriate. And then he says, but you know, it's not the minhag everywhere. He says, to just go over to a person. And I don't know who's going over. It seems that there are some individuals, very interesting, sort of, there's a Bikur Cholim society, it appears, which is very interesting. It's not necessarily the pastoral rabbi that... institution didn't exist in quite the same way in 19th century Berlin. So it wasn't necessarily local pulpit rabbi, but there were individuals in the community who were charged with learning the sensitivity around these matters and to assisting community members in counseling at such sensitive times. So he says, you know, not everyone has this minhag, and if they don't have the minhag, then you probably shouldn't do this. I wouldn't necessarily recommend this for everyone. And I thought when I read it the first time, I was like so shocked that he would even say this, that it's sort of like, oh, you're sick for 3 days, and this is the kind of community practice.
Maybe the 3 days was totally a different 3 days than were...
I don't know, or the mortality rates were quite different. I didn't get a chance to look at Berlin in the 19th century specifically, although I do know that things got worse in many major European cities, especially Western European cities. London, I want to say, but even into the early 20th century, I'm not certain on the statistic, but my memory is that I think in London, the mortality rates were something like 40 on average. That was because of the child mortality rate. Push that down tremendously, but nonetheless, it was part of life.
As a psychologist, it occurs to me to be more accepting of fear than our authors have.
Go ahead.
I have been in a variety of situations where death was a possibility, and I didn't happen to be very fearful. That's what happened. But if a person was very fearful, if you can't be afraid of death, what are you permitted to be afraid of? Mm-hmm, it seems to me like a perfectly reasonable response.
100%. And that's what I was saying. It's such an important point. My understanding of sources is not to say to an individual, don't be afraid. My understanding is don't allow the fear to interfere where the person would be receptive to the message, with the importance of making sure that things are arranged. That's my understanding of these sources. I certainly, that's what I would recommend.
This is just related to the 3 days. Yeah. It is a norm in many places that if you're out 3 days in a row, you have to have a doctor's note to go back. And so there's something about 3 days of it being
there's a history.
There must be, because that's you need a doctor's note to be able to go back to.
That's very interesting. And I just wonder aloud, this may be completely disconnected, but there's a tradition. Right. I mean, we live in different times. It's fascinating. The way that we live with death is it's obviously surreal, and yet it's still culturally, I think, we encounter it in a different kind of way. And for example, I always point to the flight of the cemetery from the center of town or from the church graveyard and so on and so forth to the outskirts. And there's a long history of this. It used to be that cemeteries were always smack in the middle of town. That was just something. You know, you read these stories and these novels and so on, and the children are playing in the church graveyard or that kind of thing, or community cemetery, right? That's a norm. Right, Tom Sawyer, you know, that's like, it was just, right? It's not a place where, I mean, they were going to make trouble, but it was something that kids did.
It was easy
access. You're right. It was a part of your community experience, and nowadays I think that's different. So we still confront it, but I think things have changed a little bit in terms of that. I think it's fascinating. Oh, so I was going to mention, I don't know if it's related or not, but this notion in the Midrashim, in Chazal, that the third day after circumcision is the most dangerous, which I don't think is medically the assumption nowadays, but I'm thinking aloud. I'm thinking associatively.
They bring it because of when they were trying to show how Abraham was went above and beyond.
A Yom HaShlishi.
Was the Yom HaShlishi, which is the hardest day. That's where they bring it from.
Yeah, 100%, yes. But it takes on a life of its own, even if that's the source. I mean, there are halachot that are based on it, and it becomes a whole literature in the Gemara based on it. So I'm just wondering if that's at all connected. I have no idea if it is or isn't, but I'm just thinking about it. But yeah, absolutely. That's certainly part of the source, no question about it. And then gave this one more source here from Kolbo, which is a compendium about matters of mourning, the bottom of that same page, sort of 7, about purchasing a burial plot, these sorts of things, that there weren't always shul societies, or there weren't always these Eastern European transplanted societies that we had in our community over the last decades. I mean, larger Jewish community, they have that as well. There's even a comment of the Chafetz Chaim, the great saint Chafetz Chaim in source 8, who goes so far as to suggest, it's remarkable, the context, I'm not going to give you what he says, the context is actually here discussing matters of chesed. The Chafetz Chaim wrote extensively on the subject of chesed, which itself, I think, is a beautiful thing, and wrote about the halacha and the importance of acts of loving kindness. I think it's just, it's remarkable how much ink he spilled on this subject. I think is stunning in its own right. And then he goes on, he says, that one of the foundations for the ethic of compassion and kindness in our tradition is the idea of the halachta midrachav, walking in God's ways. In Latin, the terminology imitatio dei, but this idea of following the model of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Gemara says, Mahu rachum, afatahi rachum, mahu chanun, afatahi chanun. He's compassionate, we should be compassionate. He's merciful, we should be merciful. That's foundational to the Jewish ethic. It's an idea that appears in the Gemara, the Rambam makes a big deal of it, and many others as well. And while he's writing about this, he actually goes so far as to suggest that one of the traits that we can learn from God and from this notion of kindness, he says, an instance of kindness that we can derive, not directly from God. God didn't arrange his own affairs, obviously, by definition, but the notion of kindness extends to the importance of it being an act of kindness, where possible, to arrange these matters ahead of time. Because it not only allows an individual to get these matters in order, but it can be extremely beneficial to the family members as well, to friends and so on and so forth, to avoiding strife in the family, and just to giving a clear message, the ethical will, and all those kinds of things. He actually says that arranging one's matters before, one's affairs before passing on, is actually a fulfillment of the halachta b'drachah, which I think is a remarkable kind of position. You can go so far as to then cite classic Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, where the Mishnah says, Hillel says, Imina mili mili, right? That if I'm not for myself, no one will be for myself. Sort of the flip side of the chesed point. He says, ironically, by caring for myself, but they go together, ironically, by caring for myself, ultimately I care for others. He says, this is perhaps the most practical application of this idea. When should one be, quote unquote, selfish? When is it actually an act of kindness? Because remember, he doesn't say this here, but I think we can add, Hillel was renowned for his compassion, for his kindness, the convert comes in, extraordinary patience, extraordinary kindness. Hillel was the one who said that the golden, right, says that golden rule, that you should not do to others what you would not want done to yourself. This is all Hillel. So you have it here as well. He says it's that same Hillel. Hillel says, what should you do? Shalom Aleichem, come on in. Says, what should you do? And he says exactly this. So I think it's a remarkable a remarkable kind of thing. Now, it's very interesting to look at the history of this, and I'm no expert here, but I did notice that there's very interesting literature about this, not just in the American community with regard to the matter of wills. So we know this has become an increasingly practical matter. And here I want to start to transition. We've seen the importance that the rabbis place on the matter of putting one's affairs in order, and now I want to segue to start to talk about the practical side of it. And what's interesting is that certainly in America there's been a lot of conversation around this, but there's also been a lot of conversation around this recently in Israel, which I think is quite interesting. In 2005, I want to say, Israel actually passed a law which allowed for certain parameters to be put in place for the will and the desires of individuals to actually be put in place. And here I talk about some of the more modern concerns, because we haven't seen this so much, but the questions that have become more commonplace in addition to the whole constellation of questions that classically existed is, of course, the question of medical care toward the end of life. And so here we have the questions, and this is where we're going to segue to focus a little bit more of our attention on, are the question of those very difficult scenarios that we sometimes read about in the news. So some might here have read, might recall the case of Terry Schiavo, which received tremendous amounts of attention. She was in a vegetative state, and there was a debate between essentially her husband and her parents. Her husband, I believe, had legal authority, and ultimately won out over the parents, and there you have family members. And it's just so torturous, and it spills over into the public arena. Very, very difficult. It went up to Supreme Court, and President Bush at the time, the whole nine yards. And those who are following the story over the summertime of Charlie Ward. Charlie Gard, I think it's with a G, I want to say. So Charlie Gard was a... Does anyone see the story? Does anyone recall? I saw the story. So he was born and bred in England, and he was diagnosed relatively early on with a mitochondrial disease disorder, and essentially, barring anything miraculous, he was going to pass away, and there wasn't a ton that they could do for him. He was admitted to a particular hospital in London, and the hospital signed off on the possibility of them bringing him to New York to undergo experimental treatments. He had nothing to lose. The hospital signed off on this. The parents were on board. The neurologist, who was here in New York, was going to do this. Was going to go ahead with it, no problem. And then he had a series of seizures. And at that point, after the seizures, the hospital said, this is no longer going to work. We think that at this point, the experimental treatment is not only destined not to be helpful, but will cause additional pain. That was the diagnosis. It was unanimous. At least that's how they presented it publicly. It was the unanimous decision of the doctors and whatever body they had at the hospital to determine these matters. The parents sought to fight it, and it really exploded over the course of the past summer, and ultimately the parents lost. They lost the case in the past, and it was extremely difficult to see this case. So this has become part of our public consciousness, but of course on a more mundane level, the questions of how to make difficult decisions when someone is incapacitated, who makes the decision, the doctors, the role of the family, is America different than Europe, and I don't really have expertise in terms of these things. I just saw a no and a yes at the same time. So it's interesting. I'm not going to weigh in on that. We can speak to Israel, maybe. I don't know how things work there. But we know that these are exceedingly difficult circumstances, and it's quite helpful for one to have all these things in place, even from a purely secular perspective. And then we layer on top of that the halachic questions that arise. And here, the cultural gap, or the assumption, the difference, and sometimes it might be a chasm, depends how you see things, it depends on a particular case, of the assumptions of the doctors, the medical practitioners, versus the rabbis and halacha, these exceedingly complex scenarios and matters of life and death. That will come to some of the ethical issues from a sort of more theoretical stance later on, but we know that these are very tough questions, and obviously it's not always the case that halacha will see these matters in the same way that the doctor might, no matter how outstanding or expert in terms of the medical care. Israel passes a law in 2005 about this. I gave you just a very quick abstract from an article that was published more recently, where they referred to this article, and they did a study over the last couple of years from 2007 to 2010. If you want to take a look, I'll give you the results. Basically, they say that over the course of the last those 3 years, there was a tremendous rise in Israel of people who signed a medical will, which allows for halakhic input as well, and you can go in different directions depending on your preferences. They say, however, that at least at that time, this was published in 2014, so 2 years ago, there was still a lot more work to be done. So that's interesting. I don't know how much awareness there is. I don't know if you have a sense of these conversations in Israel.
I did a project on parents have ability to sign instead of their children if their children are minor.
Sure. Yeah, so that's another piece of it. When Dr. Reichman was here last year, if anyone who heard him, he touched on this a little bit. Yeah, so that's certainly another piece of it as well. There's no question about that, too. These are some of the concerns. Okay, so then the question becomes, so...
There were just 1,000 people signed.
Say again?
1,767 signatories.
You're saying that's not a very...
Out of 8 million population.
That's not a very big amount.
Out of 8 million population, that's pretty...
That they signed or that they got approved? Because you also have to be approved by the medical...
Yeah, here just says there was an increase in the number of right. 80 is advanced directive signed.
So you also have to have a VADA before you, so I guess that's also getting...
For you have to be sick enough already. It's not just like if I go and sign, it has no... I have to be sick before I sign it, and then the VADA is going to the hospital.
No, it's not the way it is here. That's interesting.
Here it's very different. Very different. If you get admitted for... an outpatient surgery.
They ask you if you have one.
You just do it any time, as long as it's legally binding.
You know,
that's very interesting.
Elliot's
right that they're.
You can't just.
So interesting.
No, but that's the name of the law.
But this is just an advanced device. This is just saying if X Y Z were to happen to me, this would be.
But what Miriam is saying is that her understanding is that if I would just walk in and I would just try to sign a will along these lines, they wouldn't accept it.
It wouldn't have any significance until a Vada Refuit will say yes.
They have to sign off. Oh, he's saying I can. What's their criteria?
It won't be approved.
Right. Well, how would that? God forbid there's an accident, there's a heart attack, there's some illness.
Someone's in a car accident.
Right.
How does that help?
Right.
In their family.
Yeah.
It doesn't always help. You have to remember that when this law was written, it's passing something in the Knesset Israel is very hard. And especially this that has halachic...
Because American legislation is so easy these days.
When you have halachic things in it, and it's very not easy, halachically, you have a big group that usually has a lot of control. It's not... Zerofkia that it was signed in 2005 when the Haredim were not in the Knesset.
That's the holdup.
That's when it happens.
Makes sense.
It's just like a wedding or anything else.
Saying under BB, it wouldn't have happened. Interesting.
That's exactly
okay.
Like everything else.
Yeah, I understand you can't do what you want and it has to pass all these things, but that just doesn't make any sense.
She's agreeing with you, and she's answering Politica. That's what she's saying.
Not having it at all.
Elliot's right. Either way, this is an extraordinary small amount. He's absolutely right. And the conclusion on the next slide: there is a need to increase awareness in the general population of the option to prepare advanced directives. Family physicians, oncologists, and geriatricians should be more involved in this process. That those findings, either way, presumably, it still remains an incredibly low number. So the point is well taken. By the way, this point we'll have to come back to, but this idea of the involvement of a wide range of people, and then I would add rabbis for the purpose of our conversation, is a critical piece. And I've seen, again, I'm not on the medical side or on the psychological side of it, but I have seen a number of authorities coming from that perspective, and then rabbinical groups also have strongly recommended the importance of there being open communication and active involvement of this range of parties throughout the course of the process, and then from time to time in terms of updating things. And that a written document, this is important as we'll come to the practical side of this, that a written document does not stand alone in the sense that, yes, legally it stands alone, but we have the highest chance of the wishes being honored correctly when there's active involvement from all these parties, because they have an intuitive sense and a first-hand knowledge, not just a paper knowledge, Also, the paper knowledge in the case of a tragic accident sometimes is not located, and we'll talk about that also, but is sometimes not used, is not read properly. I mean, one of the reasons for the big push, right, because not enough people, not enough sort of cultural knowledge, as it were, immediate communal knowledge. I mean, the smaller.
But in your opinion or from your experience,
yeah.
This, you know, coming together, okay, so lawyers now, sometimes somebody medical in the family, if they have knowledge, the kids, the parents, but the concept of bringing a rabbi, community rabbi, is that new for community rabbis? Are they actually doing this in communities? If people go to the rabbi and say, I would like you to sit when we sit down to discuss, you know, our living will.
I can't speak for every rabbi, yes, it is done.
It's done, but it's newer. Like, it's more our, well, I want to include everybody in the same generation, but like my generation, as opposed to like my parents' generation, or not.
I imagine that it's probably relatively new in the sense that just kind of halachic knowledge in the community has increased and awareness. There were fewer, you know, modern Orthodox rabbis whose roles, and let's say, I don't know why you choose the 50s, 60s, 70s, dealt with psak halacha, I think, on a more limited basis.
Right.
I'm sure that there were plenty of people, I'm talking about just the modern Orthodox
right.
of opposition.
Right, right.
I'm sure that my guess would be, you know, I wasn't active rabbinically at that time, but my guess would be that together with other areas, I would just say that pastorally, though, rabbis were already involved in terms of that.
Right.
So I imagine that increased, but I don't know for sure.
I'm sorry, but I think the reality is that the issues that now exist because of all of the technology
mm-hmm.
didn't exist then.
Right.
So a lot
right.
of these weren't issues then.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of things that, I mean, and also the attitude towards life in general has
mm-hmm.
changed, even in this country.
Right.
And if you're, I know people are very concerned about those who do not want, you know, DNR and all that, but there's also people who would be physicians and hospitals that would be much quicker
mm-hmm.
to support a family making choices that one might see as not consistent with halacha. So I think more and more, as
mm-hmm.
the attitude of the countries have changed
mm-hmm.
and the amount of the whole issue of costs and balancing and all the other things that have come up.
I would add health insurance companies.
And health insurance.
I mean, there's
yeah.
actually a, you know, this whole thing with cost sharing of dollars with certain primary
yeah,
care
absolutely.
Doctors, and when they're taking care of geriatric patients, they have discussions about not ordering tests, not, you know, because why are we extending trying to extend people's lives? It's very... It's somewhat disturbing.
Yeah.
Somewhat is definitely understood. I think all that's right, but I do want to come back to the initial point, which is that, for example, matters of inheritance. That would be a better example. But I think in that case, I think what I was saying is a factor.
Yeah.
For sure. That's just an example. In other words, the question of is, and we'll come to this, God willing, next week. We'll get to address this and give it its proper depth in that discussion. But the question of can I override the Jewish laws, right? The Bechor, primogeniture, and males and females, and so on and so forth. I want to arrange my inheritance in the way that I'd like, and halacha seems to legislate otherwise, and how do I navigate that? And the truth is, Jewish communities have been dealing with this with many hundreds, if not thousands, of years. It's not a brand new issue. But I don't think that issue is necessarily all that different now than it was in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and I think halachic wills on the inheritance side I think have become much more popular and barely existed, I think, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I think that's because there's more knowledge and more involvement and so on and so forth.
Okay, so does Israel, that if you can't just write a directive, and you have an American directive or a European directive, and this happened with a kid, and you're a chartered tzaddik, do they respect the American directive, or do you have to go in front of a bond, like a living will, or just sort of...
To check whether or not they trust the American rabbi, would they accept his conversion or not?
It doesn't have to be a specific form that you fill out. You write it, as long as you wrote down your what you want to happen at a certain stage, and then you have the medical, the vada levuit, say
right.
yes to it, say yes, he is at a stage that this is, that we got to that stage,
then Israel will do it. And it doesn't matter if it's in an American form or if it's in his own handwriting that he wrote 2 weeks before.
But what if there's a disagreement from what the bot wants and what the family or the person wants?
So they won't do it.
The bot wins.
Whoever says don't go with it. Yeah, well, the Vada Refuit has to le'asher, has to give a check, sign off. And if they don't sign off, you can't do it.
So an American DNR or an American living will could go to the Vada Refuit, but it's no different than another person. It still has to go to,
if you're in an Israeli hospital.
Yes. Hospital.
If you're in an Israeli hospital, the Israeli law is the one that would.
And does anyone know anything about international law?
Like,
I'm not familiar with that.
Israel.
Does anyone know if I would take an American will into any other country? Is every country is going to be different? Or does anyone have any sense?
There was a child that was injured in a car accident, and I know there was a conflict. But the family wanted what they let them do. I don't remember the whole details, but I knew it was a conflict.
In general, in other countries, patient autonomy is not a value that has the primacy that it has in America.
Is that true in Western Europe?
I think in some countries.
Really? Because I would think initially that many Western European countries might be even more so than America.
In Switzerland,
that would be my initial reaction. Not really.
In Switzerland, you could literally inject poison.
Yeah.
Like that's you can't do that here. So
in
Switzerland,
working
in Asia.
Yeah. Right. We'll come to euthanasia, don't we? We'll touch on that. I don't know if we'll have to spend an entire class.
Well, this subject of other countries is being talked of. Just quickly, I just recently found out that my long-term nursing home policy, which I'm paying lots of money for, if I'm out of the United States, I only get half as much.
Interesting.
So it's kind of a warning to others. Ask about that issue.
Wow, interesting. Okay, so clearly the challenges and the need is great. In terms, just to bring us back to the flow of the conversation, if Chazal urge us to face these issues, and we know that in general society there are challenges, and then there are the increasing halakhic challenges, and then those intersect with all the financial realities and then ethical realities that are on the ground in hospitals, obviously this is a substantial issue for our community and in general. So what solutions are available, what's in place? So we know that in general, with regard to these matters, there are two types of forms that have been developed. And what are the two types of forms? There's essentially the will, and then there's the advanced directive, right? So in other words, there are really two types of issues. There's what kinds of medical preferences, what kinds of approaches, medical treatment would I like to see in such and such a scenario? That's one piece. And then there's the question of decision-making, of who has that autonomy, of who gets to make the decisions on my behalf if I find myself incapacitated. And that's essentially the difference between the will on the one hand and the advance directive on the other hand. What's become common now, and that includes halachic mechanisms that we'll examine in a moment, is to combine these two, right, into a single document that puts all these together, and those are generally called advance directives. There are other kinds of documents that are out there that offer guidance. For example, doctors sometimes have something called a pulse, which essentially gives them directions. It's an internal document for doctors that gives them some sort of guidance. There are also, in terms of on the will side of things, there have been new efforts to create even more humane ways of going about this process. There's something, it's not on the halachic side, but just as an example, there's something. There's an organization that basically has created a document that's available online with the sort of five wishes. I think that's what it's called, and you can look at it in that sort of a way of creating a more accessible, humane way of doing this. And they've tried to work out the legal issues. It's binding in, like, I think, 42 out of the 50 states, and so they've tried to make it as well as possible. It doesn't work halakhically. But again, there's an awareness in the general community as well, and the nursing community, I think that one is coming from the religious nursing communities, we have that out there. So given all of that background, what halakhic solutions are available? In the United States, at least, the trailblazers within the Orthodox community were really the Aguda. Agudas Yisrael developed essentially, they were deeply concerned about this. They worked with their poskim and with doctors and so on and so forth, and they developed a halachically and legally binding document that they produced, which is generally highly respected. And it actually underwent, from my understanding, some development. Initially, it was highly detailed. If this happens, then this is the halach. You know, then this is what you should do. And if that happens, that's what you should do. And in this scenario, this kind of illness and that kind of illness, but the problem with that kind of approach is that, right, is that, that's right, aim la davar sof, as we say. It's an endless set of scenarios.
You have two things going on, and the answers are different for two different things. You know, like if you have two medical illnesses,
and right, and it's more complex. You can't just say if it's one, if it's the other. The reality, and then the different parts of a person are the intersexes, and one issue leads to another, and the medical treatments for one issue then often spur another, and they have to deal with that, and so on and so forth. So yes, there's incredible medical complexity there too. So this is something that they and many others have moved away from, and now it's a kind of a simpler document. And in parallel to the Aguda, with their working with their own halachic authorities, the Rabbinical Council of America has also developed one. And I actually gave you two pieces of their documentation, which are available online. If you go to the Rabbinical Council of America website, you can just find it there. These are you can download these and get a sense as to what they are. So what's here? So we're not going to walk through everything, but I'll just kind of give you a flyby and a sort of an overview of what they have. First of all, and they're open here as of August 10, 2009. And this is I'm on the page that starts, the Rabbinical Council of America underlines halachic guidances to patients and their families, etc. So they define what are advanced directives. I think I may have misspoke before. I think I said advanced directives and a healthcare proxy. It's will and a proxy combined equals advanced directives. Sorry about that. And they give that background over here. They say halachic advanced directive number two is these two in adherence to halachic tradition. And then they deal with some of the specific questions. We're going to come back to these, actually, as we go. What's the halachic status of a DNR? If you do not resuscitate, if a DNI, do not intubate, and so on and so forth. What is the halachic guidance on these things? And we'll talk about some of these things as we go. In future classes, God willing, we will look at issues such as organ donation, end of life, living organ donation, also the kidney donation is one of my favorite topics because it's a huge Kiddush Hashem. There's more work to do, there's no question, but it is a huge Kiddush Hashem. Our community has given disproportionately in terms of kidney donations in particular. So we'll look at that as well. We'll look at questions such as taking away treatment, these kinds of things. Pulling the plug is always the term that's used, respirators, and not providing nutrition and other kinds of treatments and so on. And they give you a flyby and overview of some of those things. They conspicuously avoid in number 9 a position on brain death, which we'll come to when we talk about end of life donation. This is talk about that and organ donor cards and those kinds of things, autopsies, etc. So they kind of give a little bit of background information here. So that's an introductory document the Rabbinical Council of America has on their website. And then in the next section, they actually have their healthcare proxy, etc. Their advanced directive. So if you take a look, this section starts the Rabbinical Council of America halachic healthcare proxy. So they give an introduction, they give an acknowledgement to the Aguda, they give further guidelines, they say it's available on their website, they identify the legal group with whom they collaborated on this, the information that's necessary in order to complete this, etc., and talk about where it's held. By the way, one of the points that they make, and that others make as well, we mentioned earlier the importance of having communication and conversation and ongoing conversation. They add a couple of points to this. They say, number one, the importance of updating a will every couple of years. It should be a living document. And that's important for two reasons. Number one, things change. The treatments change and our preferences may change. Maybe there's going to be a new halakhic authority. Maybe there's been a change. We've moved. Maybe we've developed a relationship with someone new, and so on and so forth. So for all of those reasons, they recommend updating it. And the other reason it's important is because when we're looking back and refining, or even leaving it, but at least looking back at it, we can continue those conversations. If these are conversations that happened 5-10 years ago, it might not be fresh. But if every once in a while, someone is just kept in the loop, we wanted to let you know, that's something that can be helpful. So that's one of the points that they make. They also do a couple of interesting things. They look at the next page. They talk about, they have two sections. This is quite common. The first section is quite common in general wills, and then on the halachic side, the second ones we'll see. The first one is the appointment of an agent. And one of the interesting things that they do is that they suggest the appointments of not just an agent, but also an alternate agent. And this is the reality. Just like the rabbi may be out of town or may not be available immediately or something like that, even on mundane matters, we know. When it comes to medical matters, it comes to halachic matters. If you have more than one person that you can call, that's a good thing, especially in an exigent circumstance. So actually, in terms of the agent, but they don't want confusion, it's recommended, which one is primary? Who has authority? So what they recommend on the basis of legal counsel, medical counsel, etc., is the appointment of two agents. This is not a halachic position that they're taking. This is something that would be equally relevant in a general will, but this is, in consultation with these counselors, this is what they've come up with. And they try to give as many pieces of information. These also are worth, by the way, are worth looking back and updating it, you know? Not everyone's only available through these kinds of things. There are all sorts of interesting forms of communication, and I'm sure I was just WhatsApped in between the time that we started, and now I'm sure I got a Facebook message, and so on and so forth. I joined Instagram. I want it to be cool, but I haven't. Thank you. I appreciate that. I haven't yet posted, but Instagram really wants my attention. So every 10 minutes or so, I'm told about one of my Facebook friends who's on Instagram, etc. So I have to. I have to get on that.
You remind me why I haven't joined it.
I was going to say, I have none of them, so I'm very happy.
I have to say, I am not by nature a Facebook person, I'm not a Twitter person, and the reason I'm not these kinds of people is that I'm a very organized person. I don't enjoy or do well with putting everything else aside and just like, okay, now I have to like obsessively weigh in a conversation and have this. And by the way, like people who have day jobs are doing this. It's a fascinating kind of phenomenon. It's interesting. It's an interesting kind of thing. I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room to have noticed this. So it's an interesting thing. So I work best when I work in chunks. So I come back to it. But as a professional matter, it's actually been very powerful to see. And as someone who wants to teach Torah, it's unbelievably powerful and interesting. I'm not sure that everyone in the world's Facebook groups do this, and I have other things coming up on my Facebook feeds, but it is actually pretty interesting and pretty exciting to be able to share a shir online and have a conversation around it. I know that's not necessarily how Facebook operates in the wider world always, but I think it's out there. It's a question of how we use the technology, not whether we use the technology. Although I will say that the more that I operate with my cell phone, my smartphone, really in my pocket, and the more that I see the kind of addiction, but not just addiction, the kind of workflow responsibilities that it generates for people out there, I'm increasingly, they've been publishing things that are very harsh these days.
Did you read, there was just an article?
Yeah, there are dystopia article. You see that dystopia article? It's not, really.
Another one in the New York Times about kids, about destroying your kids.
I don't think it's all bad, but I think that the ramifications, I'm even leaving aside for young people, that's a huge people. I think it's a huge challenge for them, and I see it as an educator, and then I see it for myself as a grown adult to see it. There's no question that it has rewired my brain. I think absolutely differently than I did 15 years ago. I have no doubt about it whatsoever. I consume information differently, and I try to be as responsible as I can, but I have no doubt that it's, you know, the plasticity of my brain, it definitely changed, no question about that, but also the responsibilities that it entails and the assumptions that people have and the kinds of work expectations that go along with that. The word dystopia is a heavy word, but we talked about this, I think, right? On Sukkot. It's very serious. Someone posted right before Shabbos in Israel, someone actually posted this dystopia article and said, and with that, I wish everyone Shabbat Shalom. Never enjoyed it more in my life. So that's one consequence, by the way, of all this, is that Shabbos is all the rage. Shabbos is all the more important. There's no question about it. But it's all the rage. You see this? Shabbos is in. Shabbos is cool.
Yeah, like what's this thing going around? It's this weekend, I think. Like
the Shabbat Project.
the Shabbat project.
Yeah, I mean, it's picking up on these cultural currents now. It's very cool.
And sometimes I hear these things, like you'll see, having nothing to do with Judaism or Shabbat, like today is disconnect day at work. Like, we're going to have one day where there's...
Yeah.
There used to be a commercial.
Ima yiftach lanu off le Shabbat, meaning off, like, chicken. It was for poor people. Ima yiftach lanu off le Shabbat, they were trying to get money for poor people. And now they changed it, and they wrote off as off. With a cell phone, like, Ima, you promised us that on Shabbat you'll be off.
You'll actually be present.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the story. Yeah, well said. It's a couple of years ago, I remember the stories about Steve Jobs, that he wouldn't allow his own children to use the iPhone. I don't know if anyone saw that. But you're seeing more and more of these kinds of stories. So we'll see where this goes. There is a very interesting and challenging but important book entitled Sapiens. And it's by an Israeli named Yuval Harari. Very interesting. He's an evolutionary historian. He is not religious. He happens, I think, to be anti-religious. I don't think that his thought is incompatible with religiosity, in my opinion, but he seems to think so, which I think is unfortunate. But it's a fascinating book nonetheless. It's not explicitly about religion anyway. It's kind of an undercurrent. Anyhow, so in this book, though, he traces the history of humanity, assuming he's bought into evolution and learned this 6,000 year stuff, etc. He doesn't accept that. It's not even a conversation for him. And so he traces the evolutionary history of the development of Homo sapiens, or sapiens in general, especially Homo sapiens. Talks about the transition inward from the hunter-gatherer stage to the agricultural stage of society around 80,000 BCE, according to his accounting. And he talks about how this seemed to promise all sorts of new technological opportunities and new openings for humanity, and he said it was a complete dystopia. He says the next 50,000 years, he's quite confident, we're much less happy than the hunter-gatherer stage of human history. He says, we thought we were getting a great deal. We were trading in, having to be nomads and run all over, not know from one day to the next where our food was coming from. We substituted it with these wheat plants that we grew in our backyards that we weren't evolutionarily wired to eat. They weren't a normal and healthy part of our diet, and therefore our bodies physically were stuck in the evolutionary stage of hunter-gatherers. Dietitians, by the way, now evolutionary dietitians, I just made that up, doesn't really exist, but they're actually the evolutionary explanations that are quite powerful and quite compelling as to why we eat the things that we do and why certain things work and don't work for us. It's very interesting, and I'm not a scientist enough to say for sure, but I found it to be quite striking. Anyhow, after he talks about this what we thought was this great new era and how it really never materialized, he has two pages, and it's unbelievably powerful, where this really interesting, insightful historian says, and it's no different than some of the technological advances of today. It's jaw-dropping. He spends two pages saying, and he says, and it's no different. My email is the same thing. We thought we were entering this new era of bliss, and he says, and he's honest, says they are positive outcomes. There's no question about it, and we can't turn back the clock. He's not a Luddite or anything like that. But he does say, every once in a while you find someone who's not willing to use email. He says, they're the smart ones, but that's not how society works. Society is not, you have to get your work done. You have to communicate with your family members and so on and so forth. It just doesn't work. So society just continues along that path, and that ship has sailed, he says. But he says it's no different than the hunter-gatherer transition. It's very interesting. Anyhow, time is late, so I want to wrap up, and what we'll do is I'll make a few additional comments next week about this piece, and then we'll transition to the inheritance side, which I think should be quite fascinating. But I just want to point out over here in conclusion that we said that there is an agent and the alternate agent. They have the same thing with the rabbi. They have the rabbi and they have the alternate rabbi. And by the way, I did the parallel share this past week, and someone actually mentioned that they worked with their lawyer to write this a little bit differently. They had someone who's involved in healthcare, and she said that they worked together to actually make some emendations to this that were legally binding. So this is a starting point, but if you have proper legal, medical, and halakhic advisors, it doesn't have to be the end point. There can be additional clauses that one adds in. This is halakhically binding and legal, but it's by no means the only option that one has available.
I'm not saying this to be funny, but you know, like, some of us have gone who did not have prenups when we got married. I did not have a prenup, so there was a prenup party, right?
Yeah.
I'm serious that I think we have to do something in our communities to make this, not just this. First of all, to make this, I mean, most of my friends, if I say, do you have living wills, I just started thinking about it because of my parents. But the answer is probably no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Sandy said her friends said yes. I said, maybe they're doctors.
Yeah, well, I want to say we, at Beit HaMidrash, Rabbi Gross, had that, just that thing. Brought everyone in for an evening,
like an
went
evening,
over these,
right, that's, right,
these things,
right.
We signed these, and he has them filed with the Aguda or whatever.
I really think
that's assuming you want to encourage it, which is fine. I'm just saying that it's not like the prenup. Because the prenup, you want to encourage for a different reason. You want to encourage it for the whole day to have
course.
It, because you want to save women. This, if...
It's personal.
You could say, this
you don't have to have it.
Miriam, why do you think it's... You're not. You're saying that anyone who would come to the any married couple who would come to
a prenup evening
or a post-nup evening,
right, post-nup evening,
let's say, for example, you'd want them to sign. You're saying it's not universal. I don't know. What's the recommendation among?
Is there
I haven't looked at this. Is there a recommendation among medical practitioners as to a particular stage? I mean, do they recommend for someone who's married in their 30s to get? Is that the recommendation? For us culturally, it's very early, and then you'd have to constantly revise it for the rest of your life. But I don't know what's current medical best practice is considered.
Any hospital, any time you're hospitalized for any reason at all, will encourage you to sign one.
So what's the norm in the general society? I assume that the halakhic community tends to be a little bit slower to be. We're not generally the early adopters of these sorts of things,
anything.
I'll give you some like historical perspective.
Please.
So in the late 90s, early 2000, the process study showed that 60% of patients arriving in intensive care units in America with terminal diagnoses. So patients arriving in an intensive care unit whom a doctor had put on the chart that they carried a terminal diagnosis of any sort.
Right.
60% of those patients have never had a conversation about what end of life would look like. That was very concerning. So there's been a big push that everybody, particularly when you're healthy, should at least think about think about these issues,
right.
And not just from the legal perspective, UDA, which is also incredibly important, but also from what exactly this means.
And what do you mean, like what? And what are your values also?
What are your values and so forth, and make sure that your family in particular knows. One other issue that I would ask somebody dealing with this is that I can't tell you how many times, not only Jewish families necessarily, but how many times there are big family splits and traumas that occur because people weren't
on the same page.
Yeah, 100%. Or
a strange child who, didn't know what the parents' wishes were comes in because they found out they're, on their deathbed. And they freak out because they don't think this is the right thing, and it hurts everybody else.
Yeah, I've seen it also.
I mean, all we can do is just make it, just like anything else, just make it a more common. I mean, I think
provide education around it. I think it's an absolutely critical issue.
There was someone here, it was Steven Steinberg's father who came in.
I don't
makes
know
sense.
Who was, but they actually gave up.
And he had an issue in Israel with his father.
Oh, really?
Well,
was that part
was,
of how he got involved?
No. His father died maybe 2 years ago. His father was well into his
hundreds. I remember when...
But
he
was part of the Chaver Kaddish.
No, I know. I know exactly how it is.
But he said they had never had issues with his father in Israel, and he wasn't in Israel at the time, and he went in. And we're talking to a man who was well over 100.
Okay.
My son actually lived with him for 2 years after he was 100. And... there was an issue because there wasn't something in writing, and it was the sister who it was the daughter who was coming in, and they had his son, and it was I don't remember, but he talked about it. He talked about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think for our community, just awareness, conversation, and education around it, and just shifting the norms, the cultural norms, like with the prenup. Right, and there are a number of other issues. I think kind of making this just a healthy part of conversation around what it means to be a mature,
right, and we'll have to, you know, like, okay,
a mature adult.
A young couple say, I don't want to, I'm not going to get divorced, right? But we've made it more comfortable.
Right.
It's a conversation that young couples are willing to at least have for a few minutes in order to sign the...
That's right. And you make it socially, right, the social norm, and so you put up smiling pictures of people who say, I signed the prenup because,
I support...
Right, et cetera, et cetera. And you just make it, and then you make the, you know, it's the party, you make it more comfortable.
But I think
and
a lot of it is education. It was then, too, with that.
Yeah,
but
here we are. I agree. I think it's a critically important issue, and this is a very small start, but I think that there's a lot more to do, obviously. Let's get on it.
Before different procedures in hospitals, I'm often asked, do you have an advance directive?
Right.
They never pushed me, but they would ask that,
right,
which is part of what got me here. Oh, well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So that just that asking. I expect I've been asked 5 times in my life,
right,
by medical.
Right.
And I will say that having nothing to do with Judaism or halakha, the people that are sitting around the tables creating those advance directives, this is just my own personal experience.
Right.
So they were created, and my mom was in a critical position, and the doctor came in and said, do you understand what she signed here?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't. We didn't understand, I think Myra explained it to me, that they actually were not going to use the paddles if they needed to use the paddles. Because that's what it said, and that's what they did. Like, so... lawyers are sitting around giving you these, telling you to sign them if you agree, so you're checking off that you agree or whatever you want. I'm not saying in this community, I'm just saying in general.
Right.
There's not, like you said, there's not enough of a variety of people educating those who are... I mean, maybe it's beginning to change. That was my own experience, but...
Mm-hmm.
God willing, it is.
Very often what you have is that it takes the Orthodox community some time to catch up, but I think it is within our power to determine the rate of these conversations, and we could take a longer period of time and not do as good a job, or we could do it more quickly and do a better job, and I do think it's incumbent upon us. Very good. All right. Thank you very much. It's a rich conversation. Next week, we'll look at the inheritance side of this from a halakhic perspective. Yeah, I'm happy to take these back, and I'll put them out for next week and maybe add a little bit.